I started out when I was 5. And at 7 I already gave a concert. And it must have been a disaster, but I gave a concert.
Do you recall it?
Very vaguely. It was in school, a school performance, and actually what happened, with it, I was not dressed as Mozart, but it was a baroque concert, and we gave the symphony by Haydn, the Children's Symphony, and I conducted and played like it was done in Haydn's time, but we were all in Mozart, Haydn, baroque dresses, you know. And then I played solo as well. I played one movement from Mozart concerto, and that was the beginning.
Well, how did all this musical activity come about at such an early age?
Well, my family from my mother's side was a musical family. My mother started out as a pianist, and probably if I wouldn't have come along, she would have been still playing. She's now 90, and after all, Mr. Rubinstein is only 87, so she might be still having a career. She went to class with Bartók, in the same class, in the same teacher, Professor Thomann, in Budapest. And her brother was a violinist, a pupil of Hubay, and a violinist at the opera, and a teacher at the conservatory. And once he went to Paris, and he asked what he should bring back. He said, a violin. So he brought me, whether he bought it in Paris or in Budapest, I don't know. It was a violin, and that's how it started.
Were you more or less pushed into music by your mother?
No. Nobody pushed me. It was, I just
you were ahead
to
of
do
the
it.
Pushing.
Well, yes, they pushed me later to practice, and this part didn't work, and that's why I never became an instrumentalist.
Well, what was your family in Budapest?
My father was an industrialist and a landowner, and married my mother when my mother was 22, and my mother gave her debut just by her first concert with the orchestra. She played a Mozart D minor concerto, which apparently was a big success, and my father fell in love with her and married her off, and that was the end of her career.
Was he musically inclined?
Not really. I mean, he liked music, but was not a musician.
Well, did he encourage you to take up music?
No, actually, he pointed out the shortcomings of a life of a composer, especially later. Very vividly. After all, we had a very large estate of 1,000 acres, and he visualized me that I will be running this estate later. And the only way, I started to compose at a very early age. I was about 7 or 8. I still have a student march. I still have it here. It's pretty awful, but I was writing music from the beginning, and the writing interested me right away, and the practicing now. So that's why I although played violin professionally until I was 18, but more or less, you know, this got me through in school, because and every Christmas, at every time our principal had his birthday, I had to play the violin. And this is the only way I got through, because mathematics and I were not on a very friendly terms, and physics didn't interest me at all. And when it came to other subjects, the only subject which somehow interested me was chemistry. Oddly enough, because it was something like composing. You put things together and something came out, you know. And so my father said, well, chemistry would be a very good thing for you to study, because he had a very high hopes that on our estate we shall have coal, and we shall be all millionaires, and I as a chemist can naturally help a lot there. So I said, when I finished school when I was 18, I said, all right, you want to start study chemistry? I said, no, I want to start studying composition. And well, he pointed out that I would make a living and so forth, and what horrible life a composer has, and he probably was right. And while he said, well, where do we want to study? And I immediately said, I would like to go to Germany, to Leipzig, because this is the best school of chemistry. Now, I didn't tell him that there was also a Leipzig conservatory founded by Mendelssohn some 100 years before. And he said, well, all right, you can go to Leipzig. So I went to Leipzig, and I did not cheat him. I went to the university and became immediately studiosus chemicorum ed musica. Well, he didn't know about the musica. But I went to the laboratory every morning. I had to be there at 8 o'clock, which meant I had to get up about 6, because you had to take the streetcar. And I had a white uniform, you know, and I worked. And I was not interested in it. That was the trouble, because at the same time I was studying musicology as well. And it was getting too much, the two. But I kept it up, because I promised him. So I had two friends at the chemistry, and they were much older. They were just doing their doctorates. And when you start out with making analysis, and you get a substance, and then you have to tell them what is in it, you know? And the first two, three were easy, and I did it well. And then it started to become more difficult, and I couldn't do it. And I went to, there was an assistant, Herr Dr. Meyer. And I went to Herr Dr. Meyer, and he said, no, it's not it. I went again, put this in, this and that in, went back. He said, is it this? He said, no. Finally, when I came close to him, he was already shaking his head. He said, no, because he knew that I can't do it. So I went up to my friends and I said, well, will you please help me? Well, of course, in 2 minutes they told me this, this, and this. I went down to Dr. Meyer. I said, well, that's fine. Here's the next one. Well, finally I came to my 16th analysis, and there I couldn't do anything. Again, I went up to my friends, and there were two of them. One of them still alive. The other one, unfortunately, fell down from a plane over London. And they said, no, sorry, nothing doing. I said, why? I said, because you have to make up your mind. You are going to be a musician or you are going to be a chemist. We can't help you forever. And we decided that we are, you either do it or you don't do it. And I was livid. And I said, this is friendship. This, you are the skunks of all centuries. You know, you don't. And he said, well, you can say anything, but we are not going to help you. And I tried again and again and again, and it didn't come out. And I said, goodbye. And I never went back to chemistry. I went straight to the conservatory, where I immediately was accepted, and kept on musicology at the university. And then I had to tell my father. This was a difficult thing, because I went home in the summer to Budapest, and he said, how's it going? And I said, very well indeed. And he said, well, what have you been doing? So I finally told him, I said, I'm just writing a symphony. And I said, well, I know that, but how about chemistry? Now, well, I had to tell him. So I had to tell him also that I'm at the conservatory. So he wrote a letter to my professor and wanted to know his opinion about me. And my professor, Hermann Grabner, who was the successor of Max Reger and the pupil of Max Reger, wrote back a letter that if anybody has the right to study music, that's me. And that more or less settled the whole thing.
Which is very fortunate. I mean, had music been denied you totally, what would you have done for a living?
I would have written music. I can't do anything else.
Among the more recent recordings of Rozsa's early works is his duo, Opus 7, for violin and piano, dating from 1931. On the Orion label, Hungarian violinist Andre Granat and American pianist Leonard Panario play the second movement of the duo, Allegretto Capriccioso.
Second movement of the duo for violin and piano by Miklós Rozsa. Is that representative of your musical interests at that time?
Yes, very much so. As a matter of fact, my first published work, this is Opus 7, first published work, Opus 1, goes back only about 3 years. I wrote it in 1927, and this is more or less in the Reger tradition, because my professor was deeply involved in the Reger tradition. And the Opus 2 is already starting to get away from it. This is a piano quintet. Both of them are going to be recorded this summer, by the way. And then in Opus 3, I start to find myself. This is a rhapsody for cello and orchestra. And Opus 4 is already variation of the Hungarian peasant song, is already my, more or less my style. If it still has elements of, which I found strange a little bit now, but I am on the right way. By Opus 7, I more or less, actually Opus 6 was a big symphony which remained unpublished, fortunately. And this is, I think, my only work which is not, has an opus number and has never been played, never been published.
There's a very distinctive Hungarian flavor to your music. In fact, some of the titles have the word Hungarian in them, such as your Opus 10, which is the Hungarian Serenade. I want to play the last movement of that, the fifth movement, Danza. Why is Hungarian music so recognizable? It has such a character to it. Is there something about the Hungarian that is strange?
No, I think Hungarian music is not the only music which is recognizable, because Spanish music is just as recognizable, Romanian music is just as recognizable. And you are more or less putting your fingers on a very interesting matter, that not many people's music is immediately recognizable, such as, let's say, German folk music. You wouldn't say that immediately,
no.
If you hear the words or something else, but if you hear the melody, this could be Norwegian, this could be something else. Or English music could be Irish, could be Scottish, actually could be American, actually, coming from England, let alone could be Canadian. But Hungarian music has very strong characteristics, that's quite true. And I heard this music on my father's estate, where I was a young lord, at a very early age. It is north of Hungary, I would say about 200 miles, 300 miles from Budapest north, and more or less untouched from outside civilization. It was a small village where we lived, and the peasants' music is a very strong expression of the people, and especially on holidays, especially on Sundays, and they all get together and sing and dance.
And they play the violin quite a lot.
And no, actually, no. The Hungarian instrument is not the violin. The violin is a gypsy instrument.
Magyar, is it?
Well, Magyar is Hungarian, but the gypsies play the violin, and the gypsies are not actually Hungarian, because gypsies you find everywhere. You find Russian gypsies, you find the Polish gypsies, you find Spanish gypsies, you know, and you find English gypsies around Epsom, you know. For the Grand National, oh no, they don't play the violin, they just steal. And the violin is I wouldn't say it's a Hungarian national instrument. The national instruments are rather, I would say, a flute, which the peasants play, or some of them, or zither, or. But the peasants actually make very, very, it's below their dignity to play an instrument. They sing, but the gypsies play. And the gypsies play Hungarian music, which they picked up from the peasants, naturally, because they entertain the peasants. And then this music was naturally distorted and transformed to their own taste. And the so-called Hungarian music that the Western civilization got to know through the Hungarian dances by Brahms and the Liszt rhapsodies is gypsy music, purest gypsy music.
Well, this dance from your Hungarian Serenade, is this your impression of what you heard as a child?
Yes. You see, I, in contrary to Bartók and Kodály, who are actually responsible that the world got to know Hungarian music, because they went around as young men and collected them. They collected 30,000-40,000 examples, tremendous collection, with an Edison gramophone, you know. And they started to use it in their own music, and Kodály actually wrote very little music of his own invention. In Hári János, everything is folk origin, everything. Even the Viennese clockwork, it's based on a Johann Strauss polka or something, based on everything. Kodály actually had great admiration for him, but he had no musical invention. Bartók did. But he was the best arranger of folk music who ever lived. So all his music is based on something, and I did not do that. I actually did only in the Opus 5, which is based on actual material around the village where we lived.
Here now is this dance from the Hungarian Serenade. That was the dance from Miklós Rózsa's Opus 10 Hungarian Serenade. Dr. Rózsa, your fame for so many people is connected with motion pictures. Now, how did you go from being a composer for the concert hall, chamber music, the ballet theater, to scoring motion pictures?
Actually, purely accidentally. I lived in Paris I had my first evening of composition in Paris in 1931. It was in the École Normale de Musique, and one of the famous interpreters who played on this evening was Clara Askill. She played my Variation Opus 9 for piano, which was new at that time. Then this duo, of which you have just heard one movement, was played by her sister, Jeanne Askill, and herself. And then there is another duo for cello and Opus 8, cello and piano, was played by the first cellist of Pierre Monteux in the Orchestre Symphonique de Paris, and so on. And the success was really remarkable because columns were in the next day papers in Paris, so I decided to stay in Paris. Of course, I knew what happened to Wagner and what happened to Berlioz 100 years before, but, you know, when you are 24 or 25 years old, you think that that couldn't happen to you. It did. I couldn't make my living the same way as they couldn't make their living. And in 1933-ish, I met Honegger. Actually, Honegger was present at this evening. That's how I met him. There were two men present. One was Honegger, and the other one was Marcel Dupré, the organist. And they both were so nice to me, and especially Honegger, who wanted to know me. And I went up to his studio, and I showed him actually every composition I have written, and he made very good suggestions. He was a great accredited master by that time. This was well after the Roi David and Pacifique and so on. And one day he told me, let's give an evening together. Somebody asked him to give an evening. He said, why don't we make it a joint evening of chamber music? And well, of course, I was tremendously flattered. And that was again with Clara Askill, who always played my music, and she played also Honegger's. And after, it was in the Salle Debussy, which is in the Salle Pleyel for chamber music, very small, maybe 300, I would say. And it was full, but we ended up, for both of us, something like $2.50, you know. And I was expecting, of course, much more, but everybody had to be paid, and that's all we got. And, well, he invited me for dinner, which was very lucky, because I couldn't have invited him. And I asked him point blank, I said, well, how do you make a living if, with your name, all right, I am very unknown in Paris, got a few good reviews, that's all. But how is it possible that we can't make more money? How do you live? And he said, je fais des films. I make films.
And so indeed would Miklós Rózsa make films, although it would take a little time for him to get his foot inside that difficult door. The opportunity came in London in 1937 when Rózsa was conducting his ballet Hungaria at Covent Garden, and his friend, French film director Jacques Feder, arranged for him to score Korda's Night Without Armor. Rózsa quickly adapted himself to the exigencies of film scoring, a complicated craft that has defeated a good many fine composers. His sense of drama and comedy and an acute sense of timing enabled him to master it. In Hollywood, Rozier has scored fantasies like The Thief of Baghdad and The Jungle Book, searing moody dramas like Spellbound, The Lost Weekend, and A Double Life, crime stories like Brute Force, The Killers, and The Naked City, and in his most lavish phase, such massive biblical and historical epics as Quo Vadis, Ivanhoe, Ben-Hur, King of Kings, and El Cid. In doing these pictures, Rozier was able to indulge his knowledge of ancient music. He is, in fact, a musicologist with a doctorate from the Leipzig Conservatory. This is Rozier's Quo Vadis, Triumphal March.
Dr. Rozier, what is the difference between you as a concert composer and as a composer for motion pictures?
Basically, there is no difference, really, because I think that if I have a certain style, you can find that in my concert music just as well as in my motion picture music. However, the basic difference is, I would say, that you have to keep in mind that motion picture music is meant to be heard by the millions and meant to be understood immediately. There is no second hearing. Whereas in concert music, you hear a work again and again, and the more familiar you get with it, the more you like it or dislike it. And for that reason, my motion picture music is considerably simpler. But as I say, a certain style is, I think, recognizable in both. To my mind, music should finish or complete the psychological effect. In other words, there is so much that an actor cannot express with facial mimics or dialogue or acting. Something that happens in the mind of people, and that you can tell musically. And to create an atmosphere of a scene, you know, if you see just beautiful trees or flowers, that doesn't tell you exactly that it's now spring and what spring means to mankind or the whole nature, but musically you can. And so I could cite another 50 examples. So in other words, for me, music is an important element of motion picture making, mostly emotionally.
But it also works directly sometimes when you have source music, such as a march for Nero in Quo Vadis.
Oh yes, but that is of course something else. That has to be very naturalistic. And in these cases, I have written all the music first, and the picture was done to the music. As for instance, I don't know whether you remember, this is an old picture, The Thief of Baghdad, with Sabu. There was a very gay galop of the Sultan, who is giving by the magician a flying horse. And he jumps on the horse and flies over Baghdad. Well, there the music was written first. And I wrote, I had a script. I knew what's happening, and we discussed the timing. I recorded the music, and then they cut the picture to it. So it's perfect synchronization of everything, but the music went first.
The strange thing about your career is the levels of typecasting. When you first arrived in Hollywood, you were doing Oriental pictures, Arabian fantasies. Then you were doing psychological pictures like Spellbound. And then you got into a very dramatic period with gangster films. And then came the biblical period. I think your career in Hollywood is unique in that respect.
Yes. Well, actually, I can be very proud of it because Beethoven had only 3 stars. I had 4. Or 3 periods, but I had 4 periods in Hollywood.
In doing the biblical and the Roman epics, that must have called for quite some study of period music.
Oh, yes. I took it very seriously. This is part of the musicologist in me because parallel with my studied as a composer, I also studied musicology. And when the first time an important picture, and that was Quo Vadis in 1950, came along, I decided that I will do it differently, that Hollywood usually has attacked these kind of pictures, because I found it rather odd that when the research in a picture like Quo Vadis with regard to the text, the actual spoken dialogue, the architecture, and anything that went with it had the most fantastic research, and a friend of mine, Hugh Gray, worked on it, who is a scholar, and everything was done as possibly near to the real thing as the research permitted it. And we knew, of course, a lot about the architecture and art and costumes, and the language was purified. There were no archaic things which were not in place. And this was naturally not the first historical picture or even Roman picture done in Hollywood, but the music was usually the Hollywood soul starter, if I may put it that way, you know, which all sounded like Rachmaninoff. So I decided not to do that. And in Quo Vadis especially, I went to a long, long research of the period, which was not easy, for the simple reason because of the Roman music of the first century, we know absolutely nothing. And although sculptures, architecture, literature, everything has been preserved from Roman times, of music, absolutely nothing. So I had to go by deductions, and inasmuch as the culture in Rome was purely Greek, Nero himself preferred to talk Greek instead of Latin, and he was surrounded by Greeks, and all the cultural functions like music, dancing, and so on, all came from Greek artists and citizens of Greece. And therefore, we have to assume the instruments were the same, the religion was actually the same, even if the gods had Latin names, but still they were the Greek gods. And so we have to assume that the music was also of Greek origin. And fortunately, we know a lot about Greek music, although it preceded about 500 years, the Roman period. There are treatises about the music, and they are actually, at the time when I wrote it, there were 11 fragments. Now there are about 13 or 14, I found more, mostly on tombstones. A hymn to Apollo, a hymn to the sun, a hymn to any kind of god. And they had their musical writing, which of course was entirely different than ours is, but we can decipher it. And the only thing that I did not have is the indication of rhythm. However, all these hymns were given in musical writing and text, and from the text you get the rhythm. So I recreated a lot of these things, and sometimes there were only two, three bars, and then it breaks off. And I had to continue with my best Roman style of the first century. But there were enough to give you an impetus to start something and a point of departure. And I created some kind of a style which probably would have been strange to a first century Romans, but fortunately they are not around anymore and they couldn't have criticized it. But they still sounded something else than the usual Hollywood picture score would have been.
Now, with Ben-Hur and later with King of Kings, this demanded an enormous amount of music of religious character. Was that a strain for you?
No, because actually in Quo Vadis also I had the music of the early Christians. You see, an interesting episode. Before we started Quo Vadis, we had a private audience, about 10 of us, with the Pope. And he had very kind words to say about everybody, to everybody, and he asked me what kind of music am I going to use. Will it be Gregorian? I said, no, this is far too late. It's 6th century too late. Oh, I said, it will be Ambrosian. I said, no, this is 4th century too late. And he said, well, then what? We don't have anything. He said, well, I have to do it again by deduction. And now my deductions were the following. We know that the early Christians in Rome in the 1st century were partly Jews, partly Greeks. And the man who brought Christianity to Rome, St. Paul, was a converted Jew. His name was Saul, to start with. And naturally, what they brought with themselves was their own religion. Therefore, this has been proven then later scientifically, the early Christian music was based on these two sources, partly of the early ancient Hebrew and Greek. Now, for that reason, I used a few ancient Hebrew melodies, which later became part of the Roman Catholic liturgy. And when the Pope said to me, are you using Ambrosian or Gregorian hymns, he was absolutely right, because part of some of them can be proven that they were ancient Hebrew liturgical songs, which became later, with a Latin text, Roman Catholic. But I have to find those. And which I did. And then there is a big hymn that the Christians sing in the arena when they are getting burned on the stakes. And this is actually a Greek hymn to Nemesis. And I just took the liberty and having new words for it, but it was Greek. So I kept to these two origins, Greek and ancient Hebrew.
Some of the melodies from your Roman scores have been adapted into the hymn book, have they not, used in current hymns?
Oh, yes, but I wrote 12 choruses out of these two pictures, King of Kings and Ben-Hur. And these are now currently used.
One of the most attractive melodies in Ben-Hur, to my ear, is the Star of Bethlehem.
Oh, yes. Well, that's my own concoction, if I may put it that way. This is rather, I would say, as a hymn for a Christmas hymn. I visualized it that way, because that's what it is.
El Cid must have been another example of musical digging.
El Cid was, of course, different, because of the music of the 11th century, I knew absolutely nothing. And, however, again, it would have been so easy to write a sort of a post-the fire kind of music, and everybody would say, oh, isn't that Spanish? Yes, but that kind of a music, which is not really Moorish, mostly, was not known in the 11th century. Now, again, you would say, who would care? And all I can say is that you would be absolutely right, probably nobody, but I would. And for that reason, when I arrived in Madrid, the first thing was now I have to know something about the music of the 11th century. Fortunately enough, Mr. Bronson, who was the producer of the picture, engaged the greatest authority of Spain of the time of El Cid, who wrote several books about the Cid himself. And he was a gentleman well over 90, and his name was Raúl Menéndez Pidal. He only died 3 or 4 or maybe 5 years ago, close to 100, and on that day the schools were closed in Spain. It was a national day of mourning, because he was tremendously popular, and this wonderful gentleman received me immediately, and I don't speak Spanish, but he spoke a very fluent French, and so we had no trouble to understand each other, and he brought me immediately books, the so-called cantigas. The cantigas is a collection of partly liturgical, partly secular songs of the 11th century, or probably is published in the 12th century, but it's mostly from the 11th century, which is exactly the period of the Cid. And he showed me exactly how these are constructed, and he was actually musically very well educated. And I never forget it, he had a library of, well, several thousands of easy 5,000-6,000 books, you know, enormous. They went up to the ceiling. And his son was a professor at the university, and he said, well, there is a book about this period, by the way, I want you to see. And he called his son, and he said, now go to the second section of right, go up on a ladder a little higher, just a little higher, yes, right from there, the red book. And there it was, among 5,000 or 6,000 books, exactly the book he wanted to show me.
An extraordinary
and he
man.
He was about 94 at that time.
There's hope for the rest of us.
That's right.
I'd like to play a little of the score, Elsie. This is some of the court music, I think used as a love theme, very gentle, delicate music. Is this your own, or is it derived from source?
If it's a love theme, that's mine. But, no, I didn't use, I don't think in the court music. Well, you see, once I got the hang of the whole thing, and then I went actually to monasteries and libraries and got all the material I needed and studied it for a couple of months. You know, I got the style, and I could have written it myself. I used a few fragments, actually, but the main thing is the style itself. And actually, the love theme, as it is known in El Cid, that's my own invention.
Now to conclude this program with and about Miklós Rózsa, here is the third movement of his violin concerto, which had its premiere in Dallas, Texas, in January of 1956. In this Victor recording, the Dallas Symphony Orchestra is conducted by Walter Händel, and the soloist is Jascha Heifetz.
That profile of Miklós Rózsa was prepared by Tony Thomas. And so we conclude Themes and Variations for this evening.